Thanks very much, Matt, and it's good to be here. I thought the all the talks that I've heard have been excellent. There seems to be a fair amount of agreement, not perfect agreement, which is a good thing, too. Bill Allen's talk, I thought, was brilliant, and I really enjoyed our luncheon speaker today. And the preface to him, what was that fellow's name from ISI? Was that Conan O'Brien that I... I especially want to congratulate Ingrid, Greg. I know she's going to be a fabulous president. And most of all, I want to thank Lenore Ely. She's worked incredibly hard putting this all together. When Lenore does anything, she puts her heart into it. And there's a person who knows how to, what kinds of things ought to get done and how to get things done. And I want to say I met Lenore many, many years ago. And we've been good friends ever since. At this little organization in D.C. that has a little something to do with conservative principles and headed by a fellow who wasn't content just to hire you. You, when you got your paycheck, you went downstairs and had donuts, and he handed it to you personally, and he said your name. And coming from a university where there wasn't always support of colleagues from one to another, I learned something about more about the spirit of America. Thank you, Mr. Fulner. To educate for citizenship in a republic means to prepare citizens for the work of self-government. The experiment in self-government is not a new one, nor is it one that has a completion date. For each generation of necessity faces the challenge anew. Under the Constitution in 1789, Americans took their first step as a nation to meet this challenge. George Washington envisioned this founding generation of Americans as, quote, actors on a most conspicuous theater, unquote, whose role was to demonstrate to the world that the people are capable of governing themselves. In 1967, then Governor Ronald Reagan reminded us that freedom is a fragile thing and is never more than one generation away from extinction. It is not ours by inheritance. It must be fought for and defended constantly by each generation. Knowing this, he said, it is hard to explain those who even today would question the people's capacity for self-rule. Reagan continued, "We have come to a crossroad, a time for decision. We should remember that the deterioration of every government begins with the decay of the principle upon which it was founded," and in that he cited Montesquieu. "This is as true today as it was when it was written in 1748, unquote. Today, many Americans believe we are still at a political crossroad, that the path we choose will determine forever the future of our nation. If there's any truth to this, then education and citizenship becomes an even more compelling task than it is in ordinary political times. But here we face a predicament. The very causes of the critical need for civic education are the same causes that make civic education problematic in times of strife and change. In order to educate for citizenship, we have to know what the particular city or nation stands for. As Aristotle put it in the Politics, education must be relative to the regime. To educate citizens in a republic, for example, is to educate them in the principle and spirit of republicanism. Civic education is not simply an intellectual activity. In fact, it is primarily an active and practical education in which citizens learn republicanism by living it. So we can discover the principle of a particular polity by observing the way of life or character of a given nation. In other words, our national character. Abraham Lincoln identified the principle of the American Republic as, quote, liberty to all. You might remember that fragment of a speech that we have of Lincoln's on this. He said, "America is not the result of accident. We are a nation with a philosophical cause. Without the Constitution and the Union, we could not have attained our success. But these are not the first cause of our great abundance. He said, quote, there is something back of these, entwining itself more closely about the human heart. That something is a principle of liberty to all, expressed in our Declaration of Independence. At that time, this principle was the word fitly spoken, which has proved an apple of gold to us, unquote. In contrast, Woodrow Wilson declared that some citizens of this country have never got beyond the Declaration of Independence, signed in Philadelphia, July 4th, 1776. That declaration is not a thesis for philosophers. It's not a theory of government, he said. In Wilson's view, democratic citizens are generally not up to the task of governing themselves. So his solution was to think of democratic society as a beehive, in which there's a queen or a king bee and worker bees, such that the more able people make the decisions for the good of society. He said, quote, men as communities are supreme over men as individuals. Wilson's disdain for the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution was not only because he believed its principles were outdated, but because he rejected the very basis for its principles. That is, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Thus, instead of the eternal standard of natural right that informed the thinking of Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Lincoln, and Reagan as well, Wilson was a, quote, progressive, unquote, who believed that values such as justice changed throughout history and throughout the historical process, which itself is a process that advances understanding and morals, or in other words, is progressive. Let me now shift gears for a moment, but I promise to fold the theme I have developed thus far back into my new theme. One of the concerns of policy analysts, pundits, and some philanthropists at the moment is the alleged polarization of Washington politics. Congress and the President are polarized. The House and the Senate are polarized. The House itself is so polarized within that the Speaker is packing his bags and going home. Assuming there currently is an unhealthy polarization in Washington, what is causing this situation? And what can be done to restore a healthier political environment? Liberals tend to argue that the causes are such things as rigid ideology, which can be remedied by easier voter registration and increased voter turnout. This would result in representatives more in sync with the people and more willing to work with their congressional colleagues on both sides of the aisle. In essence, get the Tea Party people out of D.C. and bring back congressmen and senators who lunch together. While some disagree about the polarization issue, I actually think that there's a good deal of truth in it. However, I don't think that it is just a few renegades in Congress who are responsible for the divisiveness. Moreover, I do not believe that if representatives and senators represented their constituents more faithfully, they would discover more ground for compromise and Congress would be less polarized. Take, for example, Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders. It's hard to think of a more contrasting pair of senators today. Well, what about the people they represent? What about Texas and Vermont? Texas conservative, Vermont progressive. Texas, lots of capitalists. Vermont, more than a few socialists. Texas, ranches. Vermont, communes. Texas, carnivorous. Vermont, vegan. Texas, black gold. Vermont, liquid gold. Texas, hunting camps and guns. Vermont, co-ops and alfalfa sprouts. Texas, cowboy boots. Vermont, Birkenstocks. Texas, gun rights. Vermont, transgender rights. Texas, Miranda Lambert. Vermont, fish with a PH. No Texan would ever spell any word that sounded like an F with a PH. Texas, anti-drug, pro-beer. Vermont doesn't need to legalize recreational marijuana because it was never illegal in Vermont. The Texas trifecta, cowboy hat, cowboy boots, and a very big belt buckle. Vermont chic, shorts and a ski parka. And finally, and in all seriousness, Texas, 6% of them consider themselves non-religious. In Vermont, 58% of them consider themselves non-religious. So in a sense, Texas and Vermont represent the crossroad America is at today. Why do Texans and Vermonters disagree so much, and on some issues disagree so very deeply? Can we articulate the reasons for the division in our nation today? Well, let me make a preliminary attempt at responding to these questions, though I hasten to add that this is only a preliminary and tentative sketch, for the questions are important and deserve in-depth and careful investigation. My first speculation is that perhaps Tocqueville got it right when he identified liberty and equality as the two competing principles in American democracy. Indeed, the competing principles in modern democratic governments generally. Remember what he said. Liberty requires great exertion and sacrifice, while the pleasures of equality are self-proffered and easy. Quote, I think that democratic communities have a natural taste for freedom. Left to themselves, they will seek it, cherish it, and view any privation of it with regret. But for equality, their passion is ardent, insatiable, incessant, invincible. They call for equality and freedom, and if they cannot have it, they still call for equality and slavery. Now, Tocqueville attempted to provide a brief account of the philosophic causes at work in the modern world, giving particular attention to Descartes. Much has changed, however, since the 1830s in this regard. And Woodrow Wilson's political ideas, grounded as they were in the historicist school of 19th and 20th century philosophy, is a pertinent example of the change. As I mentioned earlier, Wilson's rejection of the Declaration of Independence is part and parcel of the rejection of the idea of natural justice, a rejection of a standard of right and wrong that exists independent of mere human will or desire. This, I would postulate, may be the cause of causes in back of the serious differences in political and moral views in our nation today. If this is the case, then we are witnessing what Montesquieu called the deterioration of the principle upon which the American Republic was founded. In essence, we are facing the possibility of regime change. Let me close with reminding you of the passage I quoted at the beginning of my remarks. Freedom is a fragile thing and is never more than one generation away from extinction. It is not ours by inheritance. It must be fought for and defended constantly by each generation. We have come to a crossroad, a time for decision. In the same speech, Reagan also reminded Americans of the history of free peoples. So not only is freedom fragile, not only does it require exertion and sacrifice, but freedom, quote, comes only once to a people. Those who have known freedom and then lost it have never known it again. Thank you.